How do you choose what to remember and what to forget? Maybe you don't choose consciously, at least not always. We all have moments in life we'd like to forget, bad decisions or entire chapters in life we wish we could just erase. What happens when a whole society tries to bury a memory? We've done that in America over massacres of Native Americans, treatment of slaves, the Civil War itself. I mean, sure, you learned about the Civil War in school, but ask a Northerner and a Southerner what that was all about, and even today, you're likely to get different answers. I've done a lot of thinking about how much we are the stories we tell ourselves, about how societies remember and forget, and how the way collective memories are formed not only shapes an understanding of the past, but also a path into the future. I wrote often about these issues as a foreign correspondent, in Cambodia after the Khmer Rouge era, in Rwanda after its genocide, in China, which to this day has not dealt publicly or collectively with the political violence of the Cultural Revolution or the politically imposed famine in the early 60s that killed some 30 million people. I also reported in Japan, where amnesia among some about Japanese atrocities during World War II has been paired with a wounded sense that Japan was just trying to stake its place in the world as an emerging global power, the way European powers had done through colonialism. Was what Japan did really any worse, they ask, than what the Belgians did in the Congo, or the Dutch and the British in South Africa? And anyway, Japan has moved forward as a responsible and peaceful global player, they say. Why dwell on the past? A possible answer comes from Germany, which has been much more active in facing its past and trying to be vigilant against its darker impulses. Another answer comes from much of Europe, where those darker impulses have been showing up in anti-immigrant protests and at the polls. The past is present. The past shapes who we are. And the past can provide a warning to those who choose to heed it, if they choose to remember. This is Whose Century Is It?, a podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstad. And certainly, one of the ideas shaping any century, any stretch of time, is the idea we have of ourselves. There are hero stories, for example, the pilgrims, grievance stories, like the Serbs carrying a grudge for losing a battle in 1389 that prompted their aggression against their ethnic neighbors in the 1990s. Or in China, where school children are taught in the official curriculum that China suffered a century of humiliation at the hands of foreign powers, and now China must rise up in righteousness and reclaim its rightful place as the world's preeminent power. There are also the stories that perpetrators would like to bury. China's communist leaders regularly blame Japan for the 20 million Chinese who died under Japanese occupation, and well, they should. But they don't like to talk about the 30 million or so Chinese who starved to death in a preventable famine under Mao Zedong. Now seems to be a good time to be thinking about how things are remembered and what's forgotten, and why, and who decides, and how such decisions reverberate into the future. So I'll be doing a couple of episodes on this from two different parts of the world. The first, coming up here, is from a little town in Poland where a terrible thing happened during World War II. The second is from a place that's helped set the standard for how, as a society, to face a troubled past, even if not all the trouble entirely disappears. That would be South Africa, which I just visited. But here, I'm handing over to my colleague at the World Radio Program, Nina Porzuki. Nina is co-host of the podcast The World in Words, which has endlessly interesting takes on language and how it's used, abused, and played with around the world. This piece is not about language per se. Here, Nina is going back to the land of her ancestors, Poland, to a village, not of her ancestors, with a very complicated relationship, with a very ugly past.
This story begins July 10th, 1941. The place, a tiny Polish town, village really, called Jawabna. I went there with my producer, Ursula. Yeah. It was deep into winter.
It's not a very big village.
No, no.
It's really, really cold. Sort of snowy ice everywhere. The sky is completely white.
But that day, July 10th, 1941, was a hot one. People remember the heat.
You know, it's July, it's very hot, just the extreme, you're miserable. There are all kinds of little episodes that are documented.
Jan Gross is a historian at Princeton. That summer, he says, the region is on edge. Yevabna is not too terribly far from the modern borders of Belarus and Lithuania. In 1941, though, borders were an ever-changing fact of life in occupied Poland. The village had actually been under Stalin's brutal control for nearly 2 years, until this moment.
This is a moment in the summer of 1941 when Germany launches its attack against the Soviet Union.
German soldiers are roaming the countryside, unleashing violence across the region, especially against Jews. Gross says this is when
mass killings of Jews by Germans begin.
Tensions have been mounting for some time in the little village between Poles and their Jewish neighbors. There are whispers that the Jews were communist collaborators backing the Soviets.
We know that there was a group of SS that were moving through the area behind the frontline troops. And someone came a day before to Jedwabna and had some sort of a conversation. That was, if you will, the moment where the green light was given to the locals.
On July 10th, these whispers become shouts.
And it starts by Jewish population being ordered to assemble on the town square.
Ordered by their neighbors to clean up the lawn, weeding.
Pulling out blades of grass from the ground. Surrounded by a growing crowd, beaten up. It's a lot of people. It's huge.
The Jewish men are then taken to a nearby square where they are told to knock down a statue of Lenin that had been erected during Soviet rule. Then the men are marched to a barn on the outskirts of town.
They carry this broken up statue to bury it within the barn. While they do it, they get killed.
Hysteria in the village is now at full tilt. The women and children left weeding in the main square are corralled en masse to the same barn, where they presumably see the bodies of their brothers and husbands and fathers.
The barn is locked, and some kerosene is poured on it, and it's set on fire.
The barn burns down to the ground.
That's what happens, you know. It's just, horrendous episode, and what's so unusual about it is that there is an effort to round up every Jew. In early July of 1941, the German mass killings of Jews that were already taking place were not of that kind yet.
Today, the town square is a large park covered in snowy ice. It's surrounded by shops and houses. The church sits on one end of the square. It was built in the late 30s. A date on the gate says 1937. I peek inside the church looking for Ursula.
Where did they go?
It's school break this week, and the village kids are assembled in the pews for church camp. A few girls pastor a young priest with a guitar about what to sing next. My producer, Ursula, speaks with the young popular priest. His name is Father Seraphine. Will he talk with us about the history of the town? Sure, he says, after Mass. If wars leave scars, then Poland has a deep red gash through its middle. Poland was the epicenter of World War II in Europe. For 6 years, the country was fought on both fronts. Stalin from the east and Germans from the west. 5 million Poles died during the war, 3 million of those Polish Jews. That's one-fifth of the population. No village was untouched. And today, if you walk around any Polish town or village, big or small, it's impossible, it seems, not to bump into some monument commemorating the war. What does this do to a nation? Michal Bilewicz studies hate.
The scale of hate speech, the mechanisms of hate speech, why people use hate speech, how hate speech that you can witness on the internet, in the news, how does it affect our attitudes?
He's a professor of psychology at the Center for Research on Prejudice at the University of Warsaw. Growing up in Poland, he noticed what he calls the, quote, remnants of Poland's diversity. Abandoned Jewish cemeteries, memorials to massacres. And he wonders as well, how do all of these remnants affect the psyche of a nation, his nation?
The country that's affected so much by genocide, historical genocide, it becomes a very salient issue.
I met Belewicz after he presented his most recent study at the Sejm, the Polish parliament. He was alarmed to discover in his study that over the past 2 years in Poland, there has been a marked uptick in anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, though there are very few Jews and even fewer Muslims.
In a country that has no immigration, it was absurd.
But this absurdity may be key to understanding this bump, according to Belewicz. In 2015, Poland elected a right-wing nationalist party, the Law and Justice Party, also known as PiS, and they campaigned on a platform of Poland First. Anti-immigrant rhetoric was rampant.
So they expressed very often the question of incompatibility of Islam and the European values and European culture. But this was not the biggest argument that they used. The biggest argument was an argument which I consider a purely racist and biological one. The leader of Law and Justice,
a man named Jarosław Kaczyński,
said that the refugees might be spreading parasites, illnesses. Their influx in Europe is actually a biological risk. This is something he openly expressed publicly. And then he presents himself and his party as the defender of the nation. And this is how you make voters.
It's like very scarily reminiscent of Nazis and Jews painting a picture of the disease.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the imagery that you can refer to is from actually the propaganda the Nazis use to make people outside of the ghetto not help Jews. When we remember these posters, Jews are rats. The Soviets are bringing rats together with them, and the rats were Jews. This imagery was used on Nazi posters in the occupied Europe, and particularly the occupied Poland. Why? Because this is a very effective way of reducing a chance of any helping behavior.
From 2014 until 2016, Belewicz says hate speech online and on television in Poland grew at an alarming rate.
People declare that they see hate speech twice more often now than they did 2 years ago.
This is the same period as the Polish election, when the Law and Justice Party campaigned on their anti-immigrant platform. It's also the period when refugees are arriving in record numbers to Europe. And the thing is, the more hate speech we see, the more we stop seeing it, according to Belewicz.
People lose their sensitivity. They start treating it as a normal language, as an everyday language. And this is very dangerous, because the more normal it gets, the more people are willing to offend other ethnic minorities themselves.
Since coming to power, the Law and Justice Party has refused to resettle refugees arriving in Europe. Ursula and I wait quietly at the back of the church. I'm not sure what I expect to find out of coming to Jawabna. I'm curious how townspeople feel about this history. I mean, what do they believe? Mass ends. We look for Father Serafin. He is nowhere to be found. We walk to the rectory behind the church in search of the missing Father Serafin.
I mean, I wouldn't want to talk either.
Knock on the door. Another priest appears. Ursula inquires after the father. The priest at the door tells us Father Serafin is no longer available to speak with us. No one is available to speak with us.
He chickened out.
Nothing to do with it.
He doesn't want to talk.
For nearly 60 years in Jawabna, there's a monument on the edge of town at the site of the barn. It commemorated the mass murder of the Jews at the hands of the Germans.
But this is untrue. They were killed by local people.
In 2000, Jan Gross published a slim book entitled Neighbors that shook Poland to its core. In the book, he attributes the events on that July day not to the Germans, but to Poles. Neighbors killing neighbors.
How does something like this kind of just like disappear? That's my question. Like, how does this kind of...
I don't have an answer to it. I don't have a good answer to it. But my first answer to it is that it did not disappear at all. One of the striking phenomena that one had to come to grips with was that there was local memory of this killing. This was extremely well preserved. The fact that local people have killed those Jews was known actually to the young generation, to people who were not living at the time. The knowledge of it has been there all the time.
Could it be true? Did the townspeople of Yavabna kill their neighbors? This was not the narrative Poles have been telling themselves for nearly 60 years. No, during World War II, Poland was occupied by the Germans, remember? Germans killed, Poles witnessed. Except Gross's book flips the narrative, ripping open this dark chapter in Polish history. He cites testimony from survivors and records from a trial after the war. Poles were not just victims. This put the entire country on edge.
I didn't anticipate the kind of reaction which followed. The whole country was for several months totally immersed in this debate.
In 2001, reporters swarmed the village of Yavabna, and debates consumed Polish TV talk shows. The Institute of National Remembrance, a government agency that was formed to examine crimes of the past, began an investigation at the site of the barn. They exhumed bodies and found keys of the victims who had taken care to lock their homes that day. They found the statue of Lenin. They also found bullet casings. The Institute of National Remembrance published a many-volume report confirming the narrative that Poles were indeed responsible for the deaths of their neighbors. And it wasn't just in Yavabna they found. Many villages in the region experienced similar events. We approach an older man on the street. His face is rough and red. He doesn't want to give us his name. He says he's from around. Ursula asks him if he's been to the Jewish monument. As he answers, the older man slowly shrinks away from us behind a car. Ursula interprets.
I've been once to the monument of the Jewish monument, and I saw on the TV when President Kwaśniewski opened the whole celebration, but they were talking that that Poles kills all the Jews, and well, I don't know myself. I can't know.
The older man is referring to July 10th, 2001, the 60th anniversary of the massacre.
A national ceremony was organized.
The whole country tuned into that ceremony on TV.
The president of Poland came there. A new monument was put up. The old one that attributed the murder to Germans was removed. The then president, Aleksander Kwaśniewski, spoke.
The president apologized to the Jewish nation. Leaders from the Catholic clergy spoke. And the Israeli ambassador to Poland at the time, Shevek Weiss, also spoke that day. Weiss is a Polish Jew and a Holocaust survivor, and his speech was perhaps the most striking moment of the ceremony.
He said, and this was very memorable, that there were all kinds of barns in Poland, the one like in Yavabna, but also a barn in which he and his family were saved.
Weiss had been saved by a neighbor, hidden in a barn.
It was a very, very important moment. However, the Yavabna population, the population of the city of Yavabna, was not taking part of it.
While the nation wrestled with its dark past, the town of Yavabna withdrew. The day the president came to town, the villagers largely did not show up for the ceremony.
You know, there was a lot of press from all over the world. The president of Poland came, and the town was shut down. People were in their homes behind closed windows, and there was a priest who lived there at the time, he's deceased, who just was a complete denier, maintained that it was the Germans who had killed the Jews there, and essentially created a kind of an atmosphere of censorship. Only the mayor of town showed up. He was later chased out of this town and ended up in Chicago.
In the years after Gross's book, the Polish government has worked hard to highlight that other kind of barn, the barn that Israeli Ambassador Shevek Weiss spoke about at the commemoration, the barn that saved him.
And I don't see anything bad in commemorating the righteous.
Again, psychology professor Michal Bilewicz.
But the problem is the way it is conveyed today, because the way it is conveyed is, to me, a blasphemy to the memory of the righteous.
There's been pamphlets and books written, speeches given about the righteous of the nation. Last year, the first museum even opened, dedicated to a family of Poles who saved Jews during the war. This year, on Holocaust Memorial Day, Polish Airlines, LOT, handed out a pamphlet to each passenger about the righteous of the nation.
This is creating an impression that everybody was righteous.
And that's just not true, he says. In fact, helping behavior is rare for us humans.
If someone fainted on the street, how many people will help that person? Only a few people. We know it from experimental studies in psychology that helping behavior is very rare. In a normal situation where there is no risk of helping, and in a situation of war, it's extremely rare. In a situation of occupation where you risk your life, where Nazi propaganda, which also builds these psychological walls between Poles and Jews, how many people did help? Not many. And so now I see this process in Poland of building the identity of a rescuing society, that the whole society was collectively rescuing Jews during the Nazi occupation. And this attempt, I really consider it to be a blasphemous attempt of humiliating the real memory of those heroes who were rescuing Jews. And for me, it's a very personal issue because my family members, my grandfather and my grandmother, survived the war also with the help of heroic people during the Holocaust. And I really want these people to be commemorated properly, and their names are in Yad Vashem. And also the memories of my grandparents were that not everybody, far not everybody, was rescuing Jews in Poland during the Nazi occupation. And for many Jews, including my grandmother, Poles posed greater risk to her survival than Germans, because the Germans could not recognize who's Jewish and who's not Jewish, and Poles could recognize. And in case of my grandfather, who was a Jewish partisan, their troops in the forest were afraid not only of the Nazis, but also of Polish partisans who were killing Jews. So these are personal memories. Sorry, I mean, it's not maybe a topic for, you know, intellectual debate about psychology of xenophobia in Poland, but these memories do not get represented in the new Polish historical memory.
Ignoring this murkier narrative and promoting the story that every Pole was righteous makes it easy to ignore and even deny what happened in Jawabna, says Bilewicz. In fact, in an interview last summer, Poland's Minister of Education, Anna Zalewska, backtracked on the story. The tragic situation that took place in Jawabna is controversial. Many historians, eminent professors, show completely different scenarios, she said. Zalewska is not alone. The current Polish president, Andrzej Duda, has been wishy-washy on the topic of the Holocaust. We did not, as we are falsely accused by others, participate in the Holocaust, he said in a televised debate in 2015. Back in town, Ursula gets word that two women at the cultural center might be willing to talk with us about the history of the town. Inside, we meet Marzina and Katarzyna. Katarzyna is an elementary school teacher in town. She's got curly brown hair and round, sweet face. Her colleague, Marzina, is a bottle blonde with blue eyeshadow. They both run the arts programming for the kids at the center. They're about mid-30s, neither cracks a smile. They offer us tea and biscuits.
Very nice. Where are you from?
Jawabna.
You're from Jawabna?
Mm-hmm.
They're nervous. Oh,
nice. Mm-hmm. Small, it's a nice, small, pretty town.
I'm nervous.
Have you gotten tired of Jawabna always being in the news and being an example of some hard history?
Marzina answers as Ursula translates.
I was touched
personally because at the time I was working hard till 5 p.m. and I just went back home, and most of the news I had that was from the TV. I was not involved in any celebrations here, and I have no bigger thoughts on it.
Katarzyna chimes in. She tells us that the local community felt totally isolated from the debate in 2001, that they had to accept what these outsiders were saying about their town and their ancestors, that there was no debate, that they didn't know what to believe, and they still don't.
Did she hear before, like, Jan Gross's book and before the sort of news broke out, did people talk about this? Was it actually?
A czy ten te wydarzenia właśnie trzymając?
At this point, their shyness has completely worn off. Both women grow animated, angry even, talking over each other. Ursula translates.
So that was, Marjana says that that was shocking for me to hear all those news, because I remember having this little monument in the, it was always there, much smaller. It was said that the Jews were killed by Germans here. And to commemorate them, we even went to the monument from time to time. Someone lighted a candle, and it was like always present in the map of the town. But then when I heard about the whole story, it was just a total shock for me. I said to myself, like, I'm living here from like all my life, and I didn't hear about those events. How is it possible? And then Katarzyna explained that it is even more difficult for people to understand, to deal with this heritage, horrible heritage that they got, because they are a new generation that had nothing to do with those events. They just received a news one day that maybe, probably their families were involved, and they couldn't say. People who were probably present at the time, they were not there anymore, so they couldn't ask anyone. But they were just left with the feeling of guiltness and nothing else.
They tell us that they do not believe the findings from the investigation done by the Institute of National Remembrance. Remember, they exhumed the bodies, found the keys, the bust of Lenin. Walking out of the cultural center, my producer Ursula is upset.
They have no idea. I'm sorry, but that was my impression. Like, the Institute of National Commemorance made the whole investigation. It was just closed. They just find out that it was not possible.
She's talking about the Institute of National Remembrance here.
They have no clue about the history, and this is, well, kind of understandable mechanism of defending oneself.
But at least they talked about it.
Mm-hmm. It was good.
Yeah.
I think it was good. It was really interesting. The point of view of people who... more simple people. They just inherited something that they... can't really fight, they can't really do anything about it.
Right.
So it must be really hard from like psychological point of view, and really right. Affecting the whole psyche of the community, right.
Especially it's getting late, the sky is starting to turn pink. We decide it's time to find the Jewish monument.
I remember it was close to the woods. It looked
there's a cemetery
like
straight ahead.
There are many ways of dealing with the past. Accept it, grieve it, adapt it, ignore it, deflect it. 2 years after Gross's book came out and the new monument had been erected and the Polish president had come to apologize, psychologist Michał Walewicz and his colleague did a study on Polish attitudes toward Jawabna.
We found that 1 year after these events were discovered, most people in Poland really negated this fact. They said either that these were Germans who did it, not Poles, or these people were killing because they were under pressure. They used all these exonerating explanations of the fact, not to say the truth, which was that Polish inhabitants of Jedwabne killed Jewish people in Jedwabne.
From a psychological point of view, denial makes sense, he says.
Poland very fast went to the language of guilt and shame, you know, raising societal emotions about these problems. We should feel shame of that, we should feel guilty, and so on. So it was a little bit like imposing emotions of people before they really acknowledged the fact.
And in the backlash to all of this emotional discourse and the reshaping of identity, a new narrative was born.
Law and Justice, they started exactly in the same time, 2001, 2002. They made these press conferences saying Jan Tomasz Gross is offending the Polish nation. So this is exactly the start of the Law and Justice, is exactly the time of Jedwabne debate in Poland. And this was an attempt to build some political capital on negating the fact and restoring the sense of innocence.
Oh, I'm gonna fall on all of this ice. Maybe it's right there, straight ahead with the flag.
Yeah.
So it's still sort of like in the middle of a bunch of fields.
Yeah.
The Jewish monument sits at the edge of a snowy field. The actual placard is a concrete slab with what looks like the charred door from the barn embedded into the slab. An Israeli flag stuck into the frozen ground flaps in the wind.
It looks like somebody is driving up to the monument. It's kind of interesting.
I wonder who they are.
A black car pulls up. What looks like a father and daughter exit the car and walk up to the monument.
Did you come here to visit the monument?
Slum.
Where are you from?
Yeah, we came to visit the monument.
You came to visit the monument? Do you mind if I ask you some questions? My name is Nina Porzuki. I'm a reporter with the
In the end, what did Jan Gross want from his book? From this little town? From Poland?
It's very simple. You have to acknowledge it. And once you acknowledge it, then you look around the world and it turns out that it happens everywhere. What was going on in Yugoslavia, for example, neighbors were killing neighbors. You just take a look at Rwanda and you will find that neighbors were killing neighbors. So, well, Poles, it turns out, are human beings like everybody else.
What brought you here? Where are you from?
I'm from Israel.
This is Adi and her father, Haggai.
Did you have family from Poland?
Yes. My father's family is not far away from here.
My mother and my father
are from right around here?
No, yeah. Not far away from here.
Did you go visit their village?
Yeah,
he did.
She will go tomorrow to see.
Adi tells me that her grandparents, Haggai's parents, escaped the war and immigrated to Israel. And it was a Polish neighbor, she says, who helped them escape, who saved their lives.
And that man, the Polish Rozinski?
Vladek
Rozinski. He helped the family
escape.
He was a neighbor, and he helped the family. He helped to cross the bridge. It's a story, it's a big story.
Maybe the important thing that he did something to help the family as a neighbor, and I think this shows that people were living in coexistence and neighboring and taking care of one another. So I think it's important to know that and still remember this story, that there was a coexistence in Poland, but nothing is perfect and stuff are complicated.
Haggai pulls his daughter Adi towards the monument. He wants to say Kaddish, the Jewish prayer for the dead. He lights a candle and asks me to join.
Amen.
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 A prayer for the dead, remembering. Complicated memories. So many memories of violent times and atrocities are complicated. As a student of history, as a journalist, as a fan of evidence-based facts and fact-based reality, I think remembering is good. It's important. It doesn't mean that you let one event or one era define you forever. That's up to you and the way you face history. But face it, you should. I differ from Jan Gross when he talked about neighbors killing neighbors in Yugoslavia and Rwanda and said, it turns out this happens everywhere, and Poles, turns out, are human beings like everyone else. The point is, it doesn't happen everywhere. We pay attention to Jedwabne and Yugoslavia and Rwanda and Cambodia and the shooting of an Indian tech worker having an after-work drink with a friend in Kansas because these things don't happen everywhere. They are shocking because they are rare. What's sobering, and here I agree with Jan Gross, in fact, I think it's what he really meant, is that we almost all have it in us to act in ways we couldn't imagine in normal times. And humans do tend to have a fear of the other, of the unknown, of what they perceive as threats to what they consider rightfully theirs. Why is Donald Trump now president? In part because enough white Americans were willing, even eager, to overlook his lack of preparedness for office because he said things about what America should be that soothed them, even made them feel emboldened. Emboldened enough to shoot people who don't look like them. Emboldened enough to tweet, as Iowa Representative Steve King did, "We can't restore our civilization with somebody else's babies." Yeah, tell that to the Native Americans. This is us right now, facing our demons in America, in Europe, in the white developed West, as the rest of the world catches up and increasingly expects the comforts, rights, and dignity we've enjoyed for a couple of centuries now. If we were them, we'd expect the same thing. If they were us, perhaps they'd act the same way. We're all capable of it. What keeps peace in the world and between people is tolerance and respect,
all around. In America, we built a country around that concept, even if we've lived it imperfectly. Moving away from those basic principles is a slippery slope to dark deeds. Just ask the villagers of Yadwabne. Not that many of them would tell you. Thanks to Nina Porzuki for her reporting in Yadwabne and for this powerful story. Next up on Whose Century Is It will be a look at the imperfect legacy of an admired attempt in a fractured society to right wrongs or at least acknowledge them. South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, more than two decades on. If you've got comments, questions, or just want to get in touch, I tweet at Mary Kay Magstad, that's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. Or you can send a longer email to whocentury@gmail.com. The print version of this story, along with photos and links, is available at pri.org/century, along with all 40 previous episodes of Whose Century Is It? We're also available wherever you get your podcasts. If you like the podcast, please rate us and tell a friend or two to start listening. In fact, tell a friend or two about podcasts in general.
A message from the American Podcast Council.
Every month, one out of five Americans listens to a podcast, and that's fantastic. But friend, we can do better. All this month, we want you to find one of those four Americans who doesn't listen to podcasts. A friend, a relative, the only cool coworker in your office. Find that person and explain to them, slowly but gently, what a podcast is, where to find one, and then how to listen to it. When you complete that mission, tell us what you recommended with the hashtag tripod. That's T-R-Y pod.
This podcast, Whose Century Is It?, is a co-production between me, Mary Kay Magstad, and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC World Service and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. Thanks for listening. Join us next time.